Tonight on Arena. It's film night. The Sparrow, Maxine and Orlando, My Political Biography, are up for review. And Women Impressionists at the National Gallery. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rt.ie/arena. Tonight is film review night. From the horror canon, we have Maxine, the final film in the X trilogy, set in the 1980s, directed by T. West. It stars Mia Goth as Maxine Minx, a starlet, adult film star, an aspiring actress who finally gets her big break. But a mysterious killer is stalking the starlets of Hollywood. Then we have Orlando, My Political Biography, a documentary from acclaimed writer and activist Paul B. Preciado. The film celebrates trans identity through the lens of Virginia Woolf's iconic gender-flipping 1928 novel, Orlando. First up is The Sparrow, Michael Crinion's directorial feature debut. It's a Cain and Abel story set in the moody landscape of West Cork. It's won Best Feature at the Galway Film Fla in 2022. Now it's getting a cinematic release. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have been to see all three and they're with me now. Now, Ruth, The Sparrow. The plot revolves around a family dynamic from the point of view of the youngest, the 16-year-old Kevin. What is the dynamic?
Well, the dynamic is, as you said, totally Cain and Abel. So Kevin is played by Ollie West, who's actually super in the film. He's a teenager. He's going through his rebellious teenage years, not helped by the fact that he was very close to his mother, who has died. Meanwhile, his father is extremely strict. And the film starts, in fact, with his older brother agreeing that he's going to go into the army. So his older brother, Robbie, who's played by Ina Hardwick, whom we know now from actually since then, has really become quite a big star.
Yes, Lakeland's and The Sixth Commandment.
That's right. And Lakeland's a film not entirely distant from this one, I would have said. So, and actually the youngest family member is, there's a young sister in it called Sally, but she's just kind of around to be cute, really. And so I don't want to kind of go into the plot too much because there are giveaways that I don't want to give away. But basically, both of the two brothers are in love with the same woman. They fancy the same girl. Kevin is always in trouble and he's hanging out with the wrong kind of crowd and he's doing drugs and drink and whatever else. And Robbie's the kind of straight guy around the house. And there's one really particularly chilling sequence where the father, again, a really strong part by David O'Hara, the Scottish actor, he wants to discipline Kevin. He wants to discipline Kevin, and he gets Robbie to punch him. And Robbie does it. And this is, you know, I was actually kind of shocked at that moment. But anyway, an incident happens. And I mean, I'm not giving too much away to say that Robbie dies. Kevin knows what happened, but doesn't want to say. And so he's interrogated by the police, and Mark O'Halloran plays the guard in remote Baltimore district. And things begin to kind of close in on the family increasingly as, because they, in fact, don't know that he's died, that Robbie has died. They think he's just gone missing. So there's a kind of extended search for him. And then the truth begins to come out and the family increasingly unravels.
Well, as you said, both boys are in love with the same girl.
Yes.
In this clip, we have Ollie West, who plays Kevin, and Hannah, played by Isabel Connolly. Hannah is the subject of both their affections. And Kevin and Hannah find a baby sparrow, and the bird acts as an ongoing motif throughout the film.
Here, help me. I can feel its little heartbeat. Here. Do you feel it?
Yeah.
What are we gonna do with you?
I could take it home. Try and mend it.
Really?
I saw it done on TV.
Maybe I could come visit.
That's Ollie West there playing Kevin, and Hannah is played by Isabel Connolly from The Sparrow. The Sparrow is the title of the film, Paul, and it's also a motif.
It is, and unfortunately, I don't think the film needs the sparrow motif, because you kind of know that, as Ruth was saying when we were off earlier, that it's, you know, I won't give anything away about the poor sparrow, but I just think that that the film didn't really need it. What it does well is that it's quite a familiar story in terms of a repressive father and so on, but the actors raise it to a different level. Like David O'Hara, he's a former soldier, and he's delighted when the young fellow, Aine Hardwick's character, is going to go into the cadets. And the way he walks and everything, and his erect carriage, and he just can't, he just embodies who he is from the word. He doesn't even need to say anything. And that incident that Ruth described, where he gets one of the boys to punch the other boy to punch Kevin, is kind of at odds with what we're supposed to think about him, because he's not actually that bad. The other thing the film does really well is it really gets close to what it is like to be a teenager, 15 or 16, and how the brain is not really wired yet to deal with huge things like that. It ought to be protected. And so Kevin, who is obsessed with his mother, who died when he was 7 in circumstances that nobody is prepared to discuss initially, he's like his mother. He's obsessed with her. He goes up in the attic and looks at her things and puts on her lipstick. He looks like her. And every time the father sees him, that drives him mad. So that's the dynamic between them.
Yes, there is a sense that they're all playing a role. Like the father is playing this harsh, unfeeling man.
And he isn't necessarily that, exactly.
Yes, yeah. And equally the brother, the older brother played by Aine Hardwick, he's kind of playing the role of the good son, the son who does what his father wants. And it's the other son, that's why the Kevin character is so lost, because he's trying to work things out for himself and he hasn't the sense to lie to the father.
Yeah, I mean, there is this thing, for instance, one of the things we discover is that Robbie actually doesn't really want to join the army. I had a problem with that, because we're told that as a line of dialogue, but I didn't get that sense from, and he is a very good actor, but I didn't get that sense. And I did feel that this looks great, the acting is great, as you were saying. Mm. I did feel that the plot needed the script needed one more workover to really make it work. And there were things like that.
Especially towards the end.
Particularly yeah. towards the end, absolutely. And things you like agree when there, narrative Paul. Has yeah. to tell us something, where it should have come organically through the film. And yeah. again, there is this sort of there is this kind of sub-thriller text to it. And there is one of the people around the lake, and as they beautifully said, one of the men around the lake has learning difficulties. He may have seen what's going on, and he's whistling a tune that suggests row, row, row your boat, which suggests that he does know what had happened. There could have been a lot, you know, you could have introduced quite a lot of tension around the will they, won't they at that point.
Yes, but the film really just gets one scene.
Yeah, mm. exactly that. And so the film can't commit itself to being a thriller. It wants to be a very pared-back drama, but it needed, I think, a little more than that.
OK, stars from you out of 5, Ruth, for The Sparrow.
3 for just, you know, great acting, looked great, but I think it just needed a little bit more.
And from you, Paul?
Yeah, at three and a half, I suppose. I think there are some fantastic scenes between David O'Hara and Ollie West that are just so interesting in terms of the father son relationship and the problems caused by traumas left undiscussed.
Right, 3 and 3.5. That's for The Sparrow, which goes on release on Friday. Almost a century after the publication of Virginia Woolf's Orlando, the story of the century-hopping aristocrat poet who wakes up one morning as a woman, Preciado, the director of Orlando, My Political Biography, claims that fiction has become reality and that Orlando's story lies at the root of all contemporary trans and non-binary life. It's told through a myriad of trans and non-binary voices living today are new Orlandos. So, Paul, this is a documentary, but it has...
Yeah.
Is it solely a documentary?
No, it has moments of these. I think there's 20 of them, trans non-binary people, and they put the ruffs on basically to become Orlando, and they all announce that they are Orlando for that period of time. And they do perform little scenes from the book, And most interesting of all, they describe their experiences, especially as younger people. The idea of Virginia Woolf as the patron saint of trans people is a bit of a reach, but it's an interesting one. And he kind of justifies it through the way his film plays out.
Right. And what kind of people do we meet? What are their stories? Can you tell us one or two of the stories?
Yeah, we meet this array of trans people. I must say, this is a really beautiful film to look at, and they are overall very beautiful young trans people. And so they tell their story to camera, and most of them will tell you that they started at a very early age feeling different, feeling that they weren't, you know, they had body dysmorphia. They were feeling they were in the wrong body. It took them a long time to realize what the issue was, some of them, and they're all different. You know, one of them has had surgery, and it's made him feel great. But another says, "No, I don't want surgery. I'm not really sure if I want surgery. I think I'll just stay non-binary." And what comes through is, it really is this: we don't want to be now him. And or now her. I just want to be non-binary. I want to be myself, and myself doesn't have. Don't try to pigeonhole me into a gender identity, because that's not where I want to be.
Yeah, there's a very interesting sequence, isn't there? Probably the best, where a young. Oh no, I'm going to get my pronouns wrong, but a young. It's a she.
Person.
It is a she. Because she identifies herself as she, is sent to a psychiatrist by a parent. And I think that the director, Preciado, this relates to his experience perhaps, but the psychiatrist is kind of more ogreish than they would be now. And he says to her at one point, he says, so you're a woman, he says, and she says, well, I wouldn't exactly say that either. So what it's good is investigating these kind of nuances. There's nothing black and white or binary about any of it.
Is it an enjoyable watch? Is it informative, educational? What because there is this literary blueprint going on as well from the Orlando book by Virginia Woolf.
It's very celebratory. So it doesn't raise the many problems, evidently, you know, the other individuals may face if they are, you know, considering transitioning. At the same time, I thought it was great fun. It's a musical in certain parts. It's very meta. You see the film being shot that they're in. Actors come forward and introduce themselves and saying, "I'm playing the psychiatrist in this film." It's very knowing. It's very, very lush. I mean, it's super camp, but I thought it was gorgeous. So I actually enjoyed it very much. I wouldn't say if you want to watch a documentary about trans identities, this is not the film to watch. This is celebratory. It's coming out the week after Pride. It's just saying...
It's not raising arguments.
No, perhaps that's not the thing at all.
And obviously, it's Virginia Woolf's fault for writing a book so very good that people 100 years later are still reading it and assuming that it's talking about them. But it does...
And does that work, the imposition of the Virginia Woolf?
Well, I mean, it doesn't, it doesn't. Because, I mean, we were talking outside, and I mean, in some ways, this book was inspired, most people know, probably by her relationship with Rita Sackville-West, and the fallout from that was a scandal and a great success. But she was quite socially conservative in some ways, so I'm not sure how delighted she'd be about this. But that doesn't really matter, because Orlando is a thing now, and this is as good a use for it as any.
I'd go back to Sally Potter as well. You know,
that's a beautiful film.
That is a fantastic film with Tilda Swinton. That's the great Orlando film.
So stars out of five for you, Ruth, for Orlando, my political biography.
I have to say, I really enjoyed it. So four out of five for me.
Four out of five. Yeah. And Paul?
Three for me. I did enjoy it as well, but it didn't entirely work for me.
Now, it's in Spanish, is that right?
French.
It's French,
it's
mainly,
French.
Yeah.
Okay. It's actually
it's very
French.
French, very French, yeah.
We both chorus.
Super French, yeah.
Very French.
So on to T. West's final installment of the X trilogy, and this is called Maxine. So, Paul, can you put this in context of the other two films?
You give me the easy questions. Yeah, no, I can, because I know the other films. And they're very good, the other two. And basically, this is the end of a trilogy, as you said. And in the first film, 2022 film, we met Maxine, played by Mia Goth, who was in Texas shooting a porno in this house that they've rented from this old couple, and the woman, Pearl, turns out to be a maniac, also played by Mia Goth. And then in the second one, set in the late 70s. Then we went back to 1919 to discover what Pearl's problem was, and she had major problems. And that's a really good film, the second one. And this one, we're back to, not quite to the future, we're back to 1985. And Maxine is back in Los Angeles, and she's determined to become a star. She's working in porn films still and doing exotic dancing and so on. But she has landed a part in a horror film. She thinks this is going to be her ticket to the big time.
Right. And is this Puritan 2?
This is Puritan 2.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good
film. Yeah, it's actually the
sequel to Puritan.
It looks like she's made it. But then, as I mentioned, there's somebody stalking and murdering.
This is a slasher movie. And actually, before I went to see it, Paul assured me that it was the thinking person slasher.
Well, second one was.
So I went in reassured.
Not so sure about
this one either. It's a film that is replete with references and knowing nods and winks. For instance, the film Puritan 2 is being shot on the set where Psycho was shot. So we have the full Bates Motel on the set and one of the scenes, the stalking scene quite close to the end, takes place in the Bates Motel. You know, nod, right? And then, there's lots of... they've got the big hair, they've got the denims, they've got the Hollywood sleaze, they've got this thumping soundtrack. And then suddenly they remember, oh, we're making a slasher movie. So then they quickly take apart three young women and brutally dismember them. And then they go back to all the kind of nods and winks and clever things.
All right, I think it's time for a clip. Here Mia Goth is Maxine Minx. She meets private detective John Labatt, played by Kevin Bacon, for the first time.
Oh, say... ain't you that dirty movie actress? Why, you look a whole lot taller in person. I guess I only ever seen you lying on your back. John Labatt, charmed to make your acquaintance.
What do you want?
Oh. Easy, Tiger. Don't go shooting the messenger now. I'm just the dick. Private detective hired to find you.
By who?
Well, that right there, that's privilege information.
There, that's a clip. John Labatt there meeting Mia Goth's Maxine Minx for the first time in Maxine. Is all the acting as subtle as Kevin Bacon?
I hear what you're saying. He is throwing the kitchen sink at it there, isn't he? And he is not subtle. He's kind of fun because he knows what he's doing. But he's in a scene with Mia Goth, and there are some other decent actors in this film, but she's an extraordinary actor, and she drags this thing along by the scruff of the neck. If there was, we were saying ourselves, if there's 100 people on screen, you'd find her face, and yet she's not conventional looking. She's able to express different things at the same time, and you end up rooting for this person who may be homicidal, quite possibly, but you end up rooting for her. She is the hero of this film. It's a lot less subtle than the others, as Ruth suggests, and it doesn't earn the right to the extreme unpleasantness that happens at various points the way it did through humour in Pearl particularly and the first one.
So there's a lot of other stars in this as well, playing cameos, I guess.
Elizabeth Debicki, I think, she's very good. People remember her, and in fact, probably would never associate her with anybody else but Princess Diana in The Crown.
You keep thinking that in the film.
And she is.
Diana's directing a movie.
And is she a slasher?
The director.
Oh no, she's the director.
She's the director. She's got some great lines.
She's
some good lines. You hear that in that Kevin Bacon sequence. She's got some great lines. She's smart. She puts people down, but actually she's on Mia Goth's side, on Maxine's side. She's getting fairly fed up with Maxine being slightly distracted by her personal life, which includes being, pursued by slashers, etc. So she gives her one weekend to clear up her life or lose her job. And so will Maxine survive a torture sequence under the Hollywood sign, or will it all be over for her?
All right, I think it's time for another clip. Here, Maxine Minx, she's running from a pursuer down a dimly lit alleyway. It's a dead end. We are really brought back to the 1980s here with fluorescent lights and waning police sirens and a guy who looks like Buster Keaton.
You can run and you can hide, but you'll never get away.
Buster. What were you gonna do, huh?
Nothing. I was just playing around.
Well, we're playing now.
So, Ruth, were you assured or reassured by Paul's reassurance that it's you know, it's a deep movie? It's a Hollywood movie that references Hollywood's past.
It does all those things, but I still remain unreassured because it's still basically a slasher movie. And yeah, guess what? Let's go right back to the Scream movies of the 1990s. The slasher movie hasn't taken itself seriously for decades, and this one doesn't take itself seriously very well. It's still a slasher movie. I still don't like them. Still didn't really enjoy this. So it's 3 stars for me.
3 stars for you. And were you embarrassed to meet Ruth after the screening?
No, I was. Well, I left quickly.
I think that
it doesn't have the kind of grandeur that the first and particularly the second one had. It has big ambitions. It's maybe not as well written, but Mia Goth is extraordinary in it.
And stars out of 5?
3 as well.
3. 3 from both of you. That's The Sparrow, Maxine, and Orlando, My Political Biography, the 3 films reviewed tonight by Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington. Thank you very much. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena, currently showing in the National Gallery of Ireland, and up until the 6th of October in the Bite Rooms is Women Impressionists. It's marking the 150th anniversary of the first Impressionist exhibition held in Paris in 1874. Women Impressionists showcases the work of 4 important artists: Bert Morisot, Aoife Gonzalez, Marie Bracmont and Mary Cassatt, who played vital roles in one of the most revolutionary movements in Western art. It will be the first exhibition to bring these 4 important artists together in Ireland. No stranger to Arena, Jessica Fahey, art historian, is here to guide us through this wonderful exhibition. So the 3 artists we're going to explore are those exhibited with the Impressionist group, being Morisot, Bracmont and Mary Cassatt. So I suppose we should talk about them, because we're talking about that first Impressionist exhibition. So what was the Impressionist group, and were women natural members?
So we're celebrating 150 years since the first Impressionist exhibition of 1874. In total, they had 8, and the last one was 1886. Ultimately, it was really a group of independents. So they didn't get the name Impressionism until after the first exhibition, and it was actually an insult. So this is a kind of pivotal moment in the history of Western art, where we move from one style of art being privileged, which is a kind of form of academic realism. So basically what every student would learn in school. And that in most countries, there was then a committee that would select every year the best paintings to go on exhibition. Now, if your paintings keep getting refused, you could imagine the people would get annoyed. So this group of independents decide to do it for themselves. And that essentially is the formation of this run of exhibitions. The Impressionism then is a term that relates specifically to a style that not everyone that exhibited in that group had, is much more about learning how to paint optically. So what we mean by that is painting as your eye sees. So it's rather than make time making studies and detailed accounts, you just see whatever's in front of you and paint it. So for example, Berthe Morisot, when she was talking about this in relation to her own style, she sort of exaggerated a little bit, saying she wished she could be a child again and look at nature without any preconceptions. Monet took it a step further and said he wished he'd been born blind so that he had no idea of what he was looking at and would just paint the blobs and blurs as he saw them. So this desire to be as much sort of as natural and authentic as possible, capturing a single moment as the light changes, was ultimately their goal.
Right, and that got them all with their easels going off to Normandy and Brittany and all these wonderful places.
Exactly, except women were a lot more restricted in that regard. It was much harder for them to have those kind of experiences, because women certainly of the middle class and upper couldn't go anywhere without a chaperone. They weren't allowed to go to certain places that would have seen as being dangerous to their reputation. And even if they did go outside to paint, people would just stare at them. And, you know, they wouldn't get a moment's peace, whereas men had much more freedom and liberty.
So this is what we'll see when we'll be tweeting some images, is because it, therefore the work is more domestic.
Exactly, exactly. It was the world that they were actually kept inside of. And the only thing to, I suppose, point out too is that it is a world that the Impressionists, all of them male or female, painted, because another aspect of what they were trying to do, which was breaking with that academic tradition, was to paint modernity, paint their own world from their own point of view. And that was modern life. That was people in fashionable clothes, out in the park, in a boat, inside with their children, whatever it may be, rather than painting, you know, ancient Romans or, you know, mythological figures or whatever it may be. So the women's world fit the Impressionist ideas as well.
Yes, because we know from Renoir and paintings like painters like that, fashion is a huge motif within what the women he's presenting.
Exactly.
And men too.
Exactly. And it's the same with Renoir painting children as well, his own children, his own family. So there isn't necessarily that much of a distinction, apart from when we think about painting at the ballet or maybe at the train station or certain places that women couldn't go.
Okay, well, we start with Berthe Morisot. She's the most famous, yes, as we would know her name. Tell us a little bit about her.
So one of the reasons why she's better known is that she did manage to have a little more freedom in her life and managed to stay painting for longer. Also, in terms of Impressionism, she exhibited in 7 out of the 8. So that was rare. A lot of the others didn't always exhibit. From thinking about her sort of background, her family did seem to support her and her sister, who were initially interested in painting. Her mother claimed to be distantly related to the French painter Fragonard, the Rococo painter, so there may be something in that. But ultimately, women like that were expected to learn how to paint in order to teach their children when they got married, not to be professionals. And her sister Edma, and in fact there's one painting by her in the exhibition which is fantastic to see, she entirely gave up painting when she married. So for Berthe Morisot, she managed to keep painting for longer because she didn't marry until she was 33, which was a little unusual for a woman of her background at the time. In terms then of her sort of progress, she first studies with the en plein air painter Corot, and she had a few other teachers along the way, but he would have been one of the most influential. And then she gets to meet Edouard Manet. And for a very long time, everyone assumed that because he was a man, she was a woman, that he must have been her teacher. But it turns out they're actually reciprocal sort of colleagues. And then through him and Degas, she joins the Impressionists.
Now we're going to tweet a painting, an image of a painting. It's Berthe Morisot's The Artist's Daughter, Julie, with her nanny. So again, as you say, this is a domestic scene with a baby and two people.
Yes. So this is, again, the subject right in front of her. And if we kind of think about it through that lens of just painting optically, it's not about the subject. It could be a plant, it could be a chair, it could be anything. The whole idea is to record the light in the room and as it hits whatever object it hits. Particularly in Morisot's work at this time, there isn't any privileging of subject. So what I mean by that is that background is given as much attention as the figures in the foreground. There isn't any extra detail. Just because it's the face of a human than if it is something else. And the figures in it, her daughter Julie, is watching her nanny do some embroidery, which of course was a much more acceptable activity for women to engage in because it represented one of the most important qualities, which was diligence.
Now, there's another painting we have here, again by Berthe Morisot, which I think, again, is a very famous painting. It's called Summer's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the National Gallery of London, but obviously hanging in the National Gallery of Ireland at the moment.
Yes, and it's one of the Lane Bequest paintings, so that's why it's so familiar.
Oh, that's why it's so, yeah, because I thought that, I was sure it was in the Hugh Lane, but
exactly.
Obviously, no, it's Hugh Lane.
And it's the one that was stolen as well, to make a point, back in the 50s or 60s. Recognised one. And actually for her, it's one of her most important works too, because when it was exhibited in an Impressionist exhibition, I think the fifth one maybe, It was talked about as being one of the most experimental, one of the kind of braver works. And we're so used to kind of reading stories of these women where their work is dismissed as being delicate or feminine. Her work in particular, one critic claimed that he could see the crushed petals in her palette, which is just completely untrue and certainly no more true of her than any of the other impressionists, male or female. But in the case of this particular one, when you go and see it in person, and you kind of forget the subject and just look for the brushwork, it is extraordinary how it's painted. It really is all about this almost kind of a vigorous attack on the canvas to really make it just about painting, not about what you're looking at. But if you do look at the subject, it's very modern. It's very kind of exciting. And we have to think about this if it was, say, something today, you know, pick something that you'd see on the street today. That's what she's painting, and painting it in this very modern way as well. So it's very really kind of progressive ultimately.
So will we move on to the next painter, and that's Marie Braquemond. And so it's thanks to her son that her, I mean, it's not a very well-known painter, but her son persevered and kept her name in and her work.
So she should be well-known, even without that help of her son, because when she was 17 years old, she had a painting accepted to the Salon in Paris, which was, you know, the really, you know, best thing that could happen to an artist back then. So from an early age, she was clearly skilled and talented without having access to the sort of formal education. Women weren't allowed to become full students of the Academy in Paris until 1897. So this is a long time before that. And then from that time, not only is she accepted sort of in the mainstream, if you like, but then she also joins the Impressionists and she exhibits with them three times as well. So by either standard, you know, the tradition or the avant-garde, she was an important artist. In her case, the issue comes about again with following the norms of society, and she gets married. Not as lucky as Berthe Morisot in that Braquemond's husband doesn't want her really to continue painting. Initially, he seems to support her because he's an artist himself. But as her son tells us later in a biography, that her father seemed kind of maybe jealous or certainly controlling in some way and didn't want her to follow this. She said herself that she stopped painting for the sake of familial harmony, so just to calm everything down. So this is why it took her son then to push for more recognition for her later.
So we might tweet two of her paintings because it shows the difference, her pre-impressionist and then when she's full-on impressionist. So Marie Braquemond, and the first is a self-portrait, and the second one then is Afternoon Tea. So you might just talk us through the two.
Yes, so the self-portrait would come about in the time that she's a bit more of an academic painter. She had a few lessons with the French painter Ingres, but he was very anti-women as professional artists and thought that they really should just paint fruit and flowers and nothing else. Exactly. In the terms of what it looks like for the portrait, it almost looks sort of 17th century Spanish. You can kind of see Velázquez, those kind of influences, which were hugely popular in the 19th century, particularly in Paris at this time. There was actually a kind of Spanish mania because Napoleon III's wife was Spanish. There was all this sort of Spanish music on the stage, all of these things. And in fact, we have evidence to suggest that Marie Braquemond actually looked very Spanish as well, so that would go very well with her own self-portrait. So it seems much stiller, much more traditional. And then when we look at the other example of the lady having tea, which is the much more impressionist one, you can see just how much she has changed and moved on. And this is why really impressionism, when these artists are first exhibiting, people hate it so much, because they think it's unfinished, it doesn't look like what they're used to seeing, they don't like it at all, and they think they're people who make it are mad or suffering from some rare eye condition that means they paint this blurry kind of way. And but for her and for many of the other impressionists, it's about modernity and it's about recording what their lives are really like. And particularly for women, that idea of having, you know, someone like in this case her sister pose for her, and you're recording just how fashionable she was and just what they were really like, but you're also recording it in this new and exciting optic way of painting, which she was really good at.
And she must have been excited by it, to say that she was successful enough to be in the academic salon, that she actually moved and said, I'm with those guys, I'm with the new breed.
Absolutely. And she was very good friends with a lot of them, and she would take some advice, but it seems that she had her sort of own way of doing it too. She wasn't always just following exactly what they did. She saw great liberty and freedom in it, which is another reason why I think Impressionism is such an interesting movement for women, because it breaks with the traditions that didn't allow them in anyway. It creates new subjects that they are familiar with, and it also then allows for this greater freedom of, I suppose, personal creativity that, again, suits women particularly well. And you could argue that it does look feminine in that the subjects are lighter, brighter in colour, of course, depending on your definition of feminine. But this is why I think that it's bizarre that these women were so sidelined in a movement that suited them so well.
So will we briefly move on to An American in Paris? This is Mary Cassatt.
Yes. So Mary Cassatt as an artist is an extraordinary, extraordinary individual, very determined. Although when you read art historians write about her, there's sort of gendered terms. They call her stubborn, whereas a male artist would be called determined. So you do have to sometimes bear that in mind. And she decided quite early on that she wanted to go to Paris to study because she wasn't able to learn properly in Pennsylvania, where she was from. And initially she is getting accepted to the Salon too, but then her work start to get lighter and brighter in colour, because around this time too, there's great developments in oil paint and brighter, purer colours. Plus you can also buy the tube. This is why you can paint outside. And then she meets the Impressionists, and because she's been rejected by the Salon, she fits in perfectly with them, because so are they. And she starts to exhibit with them, and she exhibits a total of four times with the Impressionists. And then the other thing that she does for them that's really significant is she introduces them to wealthy American collectors, many of them women, like Louise and Havemeyer. And they love Impressionism when the rest of Europe and, you know, most other people don't, because, again, it seems to be a better representation of their life, their interests. And part of the reason why there are so many Impressionist works in American public collections is down to the sort of advice of Mary Cassatt to her wealthy American friends.
Well, we'll finish by tweeting two of Mary Cassatt's paintings, Summertime that you mentioned and The Bath. And obviously there's the work of Eva Gonzalez also on view. Jessica Fahey, thank you so much. It's the Women Impressionists is currently running at the National Gallery of Ireland. Please do not adjust your radios. What you're about to hear might sound as if you need to retune the signal, but in fact, it'll all make sense in a minute.
Yes. Not if I knew. You're supposed to tease me. Oh, look, that's terrible.
It's not hurting anyone.
Neither are we. Oh, God.
That is the opening sequence from Francis Ford Coppola's classic conspiracy thriller, The Conversation. To celebrate his 50th anniversary, the film gets a limited re-release this weekend. When it first opened way back in 1974, what we just heard was so puzzling to the audience, they complained to the cinema owners that they couldn't hear the dialogue properly, and the management hastily offered complimentary tickets as an apology. Joining us tonight help clear up some of the confusion around this film, plus explain why Coppola made up such an experimental soundtrack in the first place, is Stephen Benedict. Stephen, what are we listening to there?
Well, okay, The Conversation is about a surveillance expert, Harry Cole, played by Gene Hackman, and he's hired to eavesdrop on a young couple's conversation as they stroll through a public square. And Harry gets the recordings from all these different microphones placed about the place, and he mixes the tapes together so he can hear everything properly, which is why at the beginning we hear all that distortion. But then what happens in the movie is the tapes are stolen from Harry Cole and they fall into the wrong hands. And gradually what sounded like an innocuous conversation gradually reveals something very, very sinister. So what Coppola was trying to do with the opening sequence there was not only unbalance the audience as to what was going on, but to prepare them for how they should listen to this film, because this film is about a surveillance expert whose métier is eavesdropping, or to be more accurate, he's violating people's privacy. Now, the thing is, you said there, Kay, in your introduction, the soundtrack was confusing for audiences. It was confusing for members of the press as well, because in New York, the cinema's projectionists had to inform the critics. Well, they didn't have to, but they informed the critics in advance that there was something wrong with the sound quality. And then when the film was released in Boston, a recorded announcement declared the previous audiences had complained about not being able to hear the sound properly. And so the management made a statement wanting the audiences to understand that the fault was not with the sound equipment in the theatre, but with the silly filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola, who had just made The Godfather.
Now, we have a clip here of Gene Hackman's character, Harry Cole, as he listens back to the recordings and then mixing everything together to get a clearer picture of what's being said. The rewinding and stopping doesn't just show us how he goes about his work, but it could just as well be showing us how an editor does their work.
Later in the week, Sunday maybe.
Sunday, definitely.
He'd kill us if he got the chance.
That sounds like a day in an edit booth in RTE. Except probably that the result is a bit clearer. But you saw there from the end about murder, and all of a sudden it all turns a bit sinister, doesn't it? Mm.
It does. And the thing is, when the movie was released in 1974, it was at the height of the Watergate investigation. So when the movie was released, a lot of the critics thought Coppola was tapping into the zeitgeist. But in actual fact, the story began back in 1966 when Coppola was talking with his fellow filmmaker Irving Kirshner about the Cold War and espionage and surveillance. And Coppola suggested that the safest way to avoid having your private conversation being bugged is actually to have it in a public crowd, because your voice would be lost in the commotion. But then Kirshner told him that he had read about new microphones that could pick out specific voices with that could separate voices from the background. And then Coppola took that idea and began working on the screenplay. But that was in 1969 when he finished the first draft. So it was another 5 years before the movie was made. So it actually, the release of the film was a coincidence when it coincided with the Watergate hearings. Nothing really, Coppola wasn't anticipating.
And you know, Stephen, what's fascinating about it is that the person who edited the film was a sound editor.
That's right. That's right. Walter Murch. It was actually, he had never edited a film before, but he had worked with Coppola on many, many different movies, and especially The Godfather. But because of union stipulations, he never got the credit that he should have gotten. So what Coppola did was he handed over everything from the conversation to Walter Murch and said, can you take care of that? I've got to go and make The Godfather Part 2. So it's actually perfectly in keeping with the fact that the movie is about a sound surveillance guy. And the editor, Walter Murch, is the person who designs the entire soundscape of the film. And if you talk to anybody who is a sound designer, and even an editor, they will say this is one of the most important films to watch and to study the making of a film. In actual fact, it was Murch wrote a fantastic book, one of the best books ever written on filmmaking. That's called In the Blink of an Eye. And in it, he explains the difference between what we see and what we hear in a film. And that is where our imagination sits, between the picture and the sound. So Murch made sure that at specific points we were seeing one thing and hearing something else. Now, he was using the great declaration from his friend George Lucas, who very, very, very famously said that sound is half the picture. But if you look and listen to the conversation, sound is more than the picture, because the way Murch put the whole film together, he can show you one thing, but when he puts the sound on the picture, you're convinced you're seeing something else. So he's painting a picture, a different picture, with the sound. And then he's also able to develop the mystery of the picture, the thriller aspect, the paranoid aspect. And it is only through re-listening and re-listening and re-listening to the sound, to the conversation, that Harry Cole, Gene Hackman's character, finally discovers what he was listening to, because he doesn't actually understand the first
time. Well, you're whetting our appetite to go back and watch the conversation and see it now as something to do as much with sound as with vision. Stephen Benedict, thank you very much. The conversation is getting limited re-release at the Lighthouse Cinema Dublin this weekend from the 5th to the 9th of July. Further details from lighthousecinema.ie. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwu and Paula Shields. Ruth Kennington is on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Therese Kelly. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.